Made possible by listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the four PEX markets in Sullivan County are being sold, and the employee-led company says that's a good thing. We'll learn more from the River Reporter. A decision by the New York State Public Service Commission poses a threat to climate progress. That's according to the National Resources Defense Council. We'll talk to them about what it is and what it means to that progress. Plus, environmental advocates were outside the New York State Fair in Syracuse yesterday, calling on Governor Kathy Hochul to ban fracking with CO2. Artist Kara Intellis and artist Rodney White are at the Derby. We'll talk to them tonight ahead of their artist talk. And checking in again with journalist Nina Burley at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Coming up, first the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Tim Walz has accepted the vice presidential nomination at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He closed out a lengthy roster of speakers, declaring the Democratic Party is one that works toward inclusion. Pete Buttigieg serves as transportation secretary, but appeared last night as a Democratic Party member. Buttigieg spoke of building his family with his husband and children.
The makeup of our kitchen table, the existence of my family, is just one example of something that was literally impossible as recently as 25 years ago when an anxious teenager growing up in Indiana wondered if he would ever find belonging in this world.
Kamala Harris will accept the Democratic Party's presidential nomination tonight on the final evening of the Democratic National Convention. The White House says President Biden spoke with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday about working toward a ceasefire in Gaza. They were joined by Vice President Harris. A funeral for an Israeli hostage, whose body was recovered this week from Gaza, will be held at the communal farm where he was kidnapped October 7th. His was one of six bodies retrieved this week by the Israeli military. His loved ones say they're grateful but angry at the Israeli government for not doing more to rescue them. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
The funerals of the six men, ranging in age from 35 to 80, continue throughout the week. Soshi Ben Ezra, speaking at the freshly dug gravesite of her brother Avrahim Munder yesterday, says it makes no sense she is burying her 79-year-old sibling. She says, quote, he was murdered after months in captivity after physical and mental torture. Mourners expressed frustration and anger at the government of Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu for not doing more to bring home the more than 100 hostages remaining in Gaza. Many at the funerals carry signs reading sorry in Hebrew. Current ceasefire talks have not produced a deal. Both Hamas and Israel blame each other for the stalemate. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks open higher this morning as a labor dispute disrupts railroad traffic between the U.S. and Canada. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 15 points in early trading.
Canada's two main freight railroads locked out workers overnight after a deadline passed with no agreement between the rail lines and the Teamsters Union. The work stoppage will affect supply chains on both sides of the U.S.-Canadian border. Business groups had urged the Canadian government to order binding arbitration, but so far Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has declined. Sales of existing homes inched up last month. The National Association of Realtors says home sales rose by 1.3% between June and July. The average sales price climbed to more than $422,000. Mortgage rates have come down a bit. The average rate on a 30-year home loan fell last week to just below 6.5%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has made an unannounced visit to a northern Ukrainian border region. It's near where Ukrainian forces have been invading Russia for more than 2 weeks. A court in Taiwan has sentenced eight of its active duty and retired military officials that it says were spying for China. The case highlights the risk of espionage that Taiwan faces from China. It is separated by just a narrow channel of water from Taiwan's west coast. NPR's Emily Fang reports the case has raised concerns about Taiwan's military.
A Taiwanese court found seven of the men, who all at some point were in Taiwan's military, were recruited by an eighth retired Taiwanese soldier. Some of them were individually paid bribes of about $20,000 equivalent to pass on military secrets to China, which had said repeatedly it could invade Taiwan one day in order to control the Democratic Island. The men also conspired to steal a U.S.-made Chinook helicopter from Taiwan and land it in China. The eight men were sentenced to prison terms ranging from 18 months to 13 years. Taiwan's military has been repeatedly criticized for not being ready to withstand an invasion from China and for being infiltrated by Chinese spies. Emily Fang, NPR News, Taipei, Taiwan.
The Federal Aviation Administration says it has asked the FBI to investigate 43 incidents of unruly airline passengers in the past year. The FAA says that's fewer cases than during the pandemic, but still too high. The agency says people have tried to break into the cockpit or assaulted flight attendants. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their travel card, Venture. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll check in with journalist Nina Burley at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in a few minutes. But first, news from the local grocery store aisle. The four PEX markets in Sullivan County are under contract to be sold to PSK supermarkets. Jason Dole spoke to Ruby Rayner from The River Reporter for the details.
So one employee-owned company, because PEX is an employee-owned company, is being bought by another. The four PEX markets in Sullivan County are under contract to be sold to PSK supermarkets. And Lee Raymer, who runs the four stores with his team of more than 200 associates, said that in 2023 they took a vote of all associates to see if they were interested in selling the PEX company, and they all agreed that they were. And so they all unanimously voted to sell that to PSK supermarkets, and that is going to take place. The transition will take place after Labor Day, so it's coming up soon. And Arthur PEX started the first PEX market in 1970s in Narrowsburg, and the company became employee-owned in 1983. And, you know, it's expanded. It has locations in Calicoon, Jeffersonville, Livingston Manor, and Eldred.
What does this mean for the employees? What changes can they expect?
PSK has offered every PEX associate their job with the same pay, the same benefits, and the PEX market name is also not going to change. Noah Katz, who's the CEO of PSK, said that this is really like a perfect match. They are also a family-run company owned by their own employees, and so have very aligned, it seems, values and business visions for bringing these PEX stores into their PSK company. And so they also talked about trying to lower prices at the PEX stores once they take ownership, because they have a bunch of other ones, so they might be able to do that and keep things running as normal.
Right. That was going to be my next question, is what changes does this mean for those of us who may be shopping at PEX? And so it sounds like if they're going to keep the name, then the only changes that they're flagging is because they are now going to be bigger, that might be able to affect the purchasing prices that they can pass on to consumers.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really rare that an employee-owned company purchases another employee-owned company. The associates with stock at PEX will receive the proceeds from the sale from all their hard work over the years, and they can do it all over again under PSK. The larger associates will stay on at PSK, and like you said, they will be able to potentially be able to lower prices because they're a little bit larger. So it seems like it will have a positive impact for shoppers, potentially, and that it will also not leave, you know, it won't negatively impact current PEX employees.
And thanks to Jason Dole and Ruby Rayner from The River Reporter for that report. You can read more at theriverreporter.com. Now, turning to night three of the Democratic National Convention, Coach Walz gave Democrats a pep talk. Democrats tried to make a broad appeal and show that their values are mainstream. And Oprah Nina Burley is there covering it all. She's a journalist, best-selling author, and publisher of a Substack on politics called American Freak Show. Her debut novel is Zero Visibility Possible. She joins us live from Chicago right now. And we're also joined by culture reporter Valerie Manzi. Nina, good morning.
Good morning from Chicago. How are you?
Good. How are you? How was night three?
Oh, it was wild. Wild. I thought night four was going to be the crowning event, but man, they had a lineup last night. Oprah, John Legend, Clinton, and of course, the vice presidential nominee, Coach
Walls, using those football metaphors and energizing the crowd. How effective do you think his speech was? It was also sort of short too. Didn't upstage the boss, right?
Well, didn't upstage the boss, but I've noticed throughout from the very beginning that, I mean, with AOC in the beginning, the short and sweet ones are the best. Mm-hmm. I mean, people start to, it's a big stadium and people start to, with Clinton last night, you know, he's always like that. He had a 12 or 16 minute, slot and he went on for almost half an hour. And so, yeah, the longer speeches don't hit, they don't leave you with the same, kind of, you're starting to fall asleep. And Walls kept his short and sweet. And, you know, the football metaphors, I wish I knew a little more about football because I don't really know what it means, to take an inch, take a yard, get in the trenches, and do the blocking and tackling, some football metaphors. But, as somebody said this morning, who could have imagined that Democrats would become the party of freedom, faith, and football?
Right.
And that's what's going on. You know, they're trying to make the broadest, lowest common denominator appeal. And of course, football is how, Rupert Murdoch got made Fox, the national voice of the conservative movement, because he bought football rights and people are sitting on the couch watching football. And then, when Fox News comes on, they put the sound down, but you still get the chyrons and you get the message. So football is the way to go. And the coach pulled it off.
And we mentioned the celebrity-packed lineup that continued at the convention, topped by none other than Oprah Winfrey herself.
Oprah, yeah. Right.
How was that in the room? I can only imagine.
Well, it was electrifying. I mean, she's a terrific media person, manager, a terrific communicator, right? And this is her hometown, and she was right up there, I'd say, with Michelle Obama. I mean, people love her. She connects. And I think the message, reach across the divide. I think that was an important message. When a house is on fire, we don't ask what your race or your religion is. And we also rescue the cat lady's cat.
Yeah.
a terrific kind of reach across. It's the opposite of the Hillary's basket of deplorables, right? And I think that's what one of the things they're trying to do here is open up the progressive side a little bit and say, we welcome you here, even if you don't agree with us on certain ways of doing things. It was powerful. I mean, it was a wild, wild night.
Yeah, there was another powerful, very emotional moment too, Valerie.
Oh yes, parents of the Hamas hostages spoke yesterday, and I wanted to know more about your response to that and the fact that you spoke to a Palestinian delegate, and what did the delegate have to say?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great that they have, parents of hostages on there, that to remind everyone that the October 7th was the instigating event of this horrific war that we watch, that people are seeing examples of on Twitter or TikTok on a daily basis, of babies being crushed by buildings that are being bombed by bombs that our tax money is sending over there. And I think that it is, you know, the big challenge really for our generation right now is to face up to this absolute moral abyss. This is my opinion. And I think it's really problematic that they didn't allow a Palestinian American to take the stage. And I, 2 nights ago was having my $30 chicken tenders in the stadium, you know, kiosk outside the actual, event. And, that's the only food that you can get there. And I shared a little table with, as I mentioned yesterday, this young delegate from Arizona. The other guy at the table with us was a Palestinian American older guy, part of the Florida delegation. And he talked about, you know, the challenges that he has with his, you know, trying to sell the Democrats to his community. He was, you know, the Florida delegation is not an uncommitted, he was not an uncommitted delegate, but, you know, this is a man who he had an accent. His name is Mohammed, and he grew up in Ramallah, and he's American. He lives in Florida, and he's losing relatives daily. And the fact that, you know, he's American and he's trying to sell to his fellow Palestinian Americans the Harris-Waltz ticket and the Democratic Party, and that they're not actually saying anything to these people and not letting them speak, I think, is a big problem. And we've had many, many discussions about this behind the scenes here about why that is. And obviously it has a lot to do with, you know, Israeli supporters, supporters of Israel who are Democrats. And so the party has a problem. There's a chasm there that is not being healed. That is a problem for them. And I don't know how they're going to. I don't know how it's going to affect them electorally in states like Michigan. Which Michigan has a very large Arab American population. People don't have another choice, though, because on the other side, you have Trump with, the son-in-law who's friends with Kushner and who is on record saying once they clean up Gaza, it's going to be very valuable beachfront property. That's the Trump side. And also Trump taking $100 million from Miriam Adelson, who has asked him to annex the West Bank in exchange for her gigantic donation.
There were Gaza Solidarity protesters staging a sit-in outside the convention. And New York Congressman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called on the convention to, quote, center the humanity of the 40,000 Palestinians killed under the Israeli bombardment, end quote, posting, quote, to deny that story is to participate in the dehumanization of Palestinians. The at DNC must change course and affirm our shared humanity, end quote. That was New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez posting yesterday. If you're just joining us, we're speaking to journalist and author Nina Burley, who is also the publisher of a Substack on politics called American Freak Show. Her debut novel is Zero Visibility Possible, and she's reporting for us at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Yesterday, Nina, you attended a panel that was hosted by yet another celebrity, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, held a panel of some of the nation's most powerful female politicians, and that included Governor Kathy Hochul. What was that like, and how was Governor Hochul on stage?
Well, it was a lovely little event. You're right, Julia Louis-Dreyfus is one of the many celebrities. This convention is, of course, dotted with Hollywood people. I think they're keeping them at bay. They're not marching them out in front, although some of them were on stage last night. But yes, Louis-Dreyfus was the panel moderator, and she opened it there are eight female Democratic governors. I think there are a total of 12 female governors in the United States, and eight of them are Democrats. They lined up, and Dreyfus was sitting in the middle, and she opened by saying, "We are what J.D. Vance might call a coven of semi-menstruating witches," which was kind of funny. They all laughed. And then Hochul was quite vocal, I would say, women up on stage. She was quite talkative and quite forceful. She did say some interesting things. I'm looking at my notes here. She said, you know, Women should not have to have the greatest resume in the world to start getting into the game of politics. Look, we have a billionaire who said, "Elect me to ruin the government." She's talking about Trump. She's been taking pot shots at Trump also at the breakfast, at the New York delegation breakfast every week. She talked about New York's, her response to the Dobbs decision. I didn't know this, but she said that day she went straight down to Prospect Park in New York City and went to a vigil and held, as she put it, sobbing young women in my arms. And she said, having what my mother's generation fought for taken away from us, we certainly took it for granted. And she says she took credit for putting $35 million into the budget for the for Planned Parenthood, so that these one out of three women living in of childbearing age are living under abortion bans right now can be getting services in New York State. But I think we should make note here that, interestingly, and it's there's a problem, because New York's Planned Parenthood clinics are running out of money now. It's 2 years after Dobbs. She didn't bring this up, but just as an aside, the Middletown and I think Goshen area Planned Parenthoods are shutting down right now because they're running low on money. And so that's something there was no question and answer, so nobody got to ask. But she basically was talking about how New York State is the birthplace of the women's rights movement, and this is why our state has to stand up. And that's why she said the first thing I had to do was comfort women in my state and go down to New York. They asked, Julia Louis-Dreyfus asked the governors what single piece of advice they would give to Harris. Hochul said, "Don't read the comments." I thought that was kind of cute.
With all the enthusiasm, all the joy, excitement that's there, this is ending tonight when Harris accepts the nomination. That'll be a big moment as well. But tomorrow, it begins, the whole fight really begins. People have to come back to their areas, and especially the delegates from our area coming back to what are traditionally red counties, Sullivan County, Delaware County, this area. How do you think they translate that joy and excitement into moving that toward votes here?
Well, I also attended a talk by some pollsters yesterday who had done some research into how uncommitted voters are gettable, let's say, by the Democrats. And I think that they think that they're going to be able to win some over by tying all of the Republican candidates to MAGA, the MAGA movement. MAGA and Project 2025 are sort of useful levers to talk people into voting Democratic. And one of the interesting things that they brought up yesterday was the fact that Project 2025, I'm sure most of your listeners now have heard of this, the 900-page document with a lot of extreme plans, really, for the next Trump administration, including firing 50,000 civil service employees and replacing them with vetted MAGA conservatives, concentration camps and mass deportations for immigrants, national abortion ban, and injecting religion into every aspect of our public life. And I think that what the pollsters are finding is that if they can tie people to the Project 2025, they are able to move the ball a little bit. Even some Republicans are not going to be on board with this. The interesting thing about it is that, and I've found this myself when I talk to conservatives, not MAGA conservatives, but let's say classic Republicans, a lot of people that they're polling do not believe that the Republicans or that a Trump administration will actually enact these policy proposals. And so the trick is to remind people, you didn't think they were going to overturn Roe. Remember, that was something that just didn't seem possible. They are quite serious about these policy proposals, and that's the way to get people to listen. So So I think that that's one of the messages. I think that they believe that they're going to be able to, they're energized. They're sending people home energized. All of these delegates are high and happy, and they're going to go home, and they're supposed to start door knocking and phone banking and so on. The trick is, you know, getting people to pay attention. I mean, there are a lot of inattentive. The 6 or 8 years of Trump have really turned a lot of people off. Because there's so much vulgarity and discord, and nobody really knows. If they're not paying close attention, they don't know who to blame for it. I mean, obviously, we think it's the Trump has brought this kind of problem into our discourse. But a lot of people not paying attention are just turned off by it. So I think that the message here they're hoping is going to be this message of joy, freedom. You know, they're reclaiming the word freedom also from the Republicans, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Tim Walz last night put a fine point on that repeated attack on Project 2025 when he used yet another football analogy, but I think I understand that we all understand this when he said that when somebody takes the time to draw up a playbook, they're going to use it. So
That's a good quote.
I don't get the other stuff, maybe. Nina Burley.
Yes, we know what a playbook is, and that is exactly what they called Project 2025.
Yep. Nina Burley is journalist, best-selling author, and publisher of a Substack on politics called American Freak Show, her debut novel, Zero Visibility Possible. She has been covering the Democratic National Convention for us all this week. Thank you for reporting live and wearing your Radio Catskill hat.
Yes.
I am wearing it around Chicago.
I love it.
I get a lot of compliments.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks so much for joining us and giving us your thoughts on the
convention. Happy to do it.
All right.
Take care, guys.
You too. We'll take a break. And when we come back, climate news, environmentalists and advocates calling on Governor Kathy Hochul to sign legislation for a fracking ban, and a decision by the New York State Public Service Commission posing a threat to climate progress. We'll have more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Vice President Kamala Harris will formally accept her party's nomination for president tonight as the Democratic National Convention concludes. I'm Scott Detrow. Join me for live special coverage from NPR News.
Special coverage starts tonight at 9, and be listening for continuing local reactions to the Democratic National Convention on the local edition this evening at 6. Election coverage on Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Environmentalists and advocates are calling on New York Governor Kathy Hochul to sign legislation expanding fracking bans in the state. From the New York Public News Network, WRVO's Abby Connolly has more.
Members from Citizens Action, Frack Action, and other environmental advocacy groups gathered outside the New York State Fair to call on Hochul to sign a bill that bans fracking with carbon dioxide. The bill closes a loophole in the existing water-based fracking ban and has already passed in the state legislature. Renee Vogelsang, New York Director of Frack Action, says the legislation is important to maintaining healthy communities.
This new experimental form of gas drilling is highly untested, and poses a lot of the same threats to our air, water, and communities as the conventional high-volume hydraulic fracturing.
She says the fair is a great place to continue conversations on the dangers of fracking and to call on state officials to move quickly.
You know, we want to be out here continuing to educate the public about what is being proposed. Many people don't know about it, and just continue to show our support to her and her administration to go in the right direction.
Vogelsang says she fully expects Hochul to sign on with the bipartisan legislation.
In Syracuse, I'm Abby Connolly for the New York Public News Network.
Now, in other environmental news, a decision by the New York State Public Service Commission poses a threat to climate progress. That's according to the National Resources Defense Council. The Public Service Commission approved a settlement agreement for National Grid's request to increase methane gas delivery rates across their downstate territories. Joining us now is Chris Casey, New York Utility Regulatory Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the NRDC, National Resources Defense Council. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Let's talk to folks and remind folks about the settlement agreement for this National Grid request. What is that, and how did we get to this point where they're going to be able to increase these methane gas delivery rates?
So a while back, over a year now, National Grid filed to increase the rates for its methane gas service to folks' homes. And there was a whole proceeding about this at the Public Service Commission. But ultimately, the parties got together and spent months and months trying to negotiate a settlement. Ultimately, a small handful of the parties reached a settlement. There was a number of parties who opposed it. And last week, the commission approve that settlement, which will essentially authorize about $5 billion of new capital investments in the methane gas system. And that will cause everybody's rates to increase by double-digit percentages for the next 3 years.
And what, in addition to the cost and the price hikes that are passed on to customers, what's this going to do to, you know, environmental concerns?
Well, this, we were very disappointed in the outcome of this case because it enables excessive investments in outdated methane gas infrastructure, which is paid for by customers. And this really puts New York's climate goals at risk, prolonging our reliance on polluting fossil fuels, increasing costs for customers, and delaying the transition to clean energy. And this is at a time when we really need to be reducing our dependence on methane gas and prioritizing equity and sustainability and solutions that move us forward to our clean energy and decarbonization goals.
And the state has like very lofty clean energy climate goals, but it sounds as if in cases like this with the Public Service Commission, who's supposed to be making sure they're protecting consumers, reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, that's it's in opposition somehow to these goals.
Yes, the New York State established some of the most ambitious climate and clean energy goals in the country through a law that was passed in 2019. And, you know, among other things, the kind of big targets in there is that it mandates a 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and at least 85% reduction by 2050 with a goal of being net zero. So offsetting the few emissions that is produced in a case like this where we are authorizing, you know, billions and billions of dollars in new gas infrastructure, it just works to lock in continued fossil fuel use for decades to come, and it makes it harder and more expensive to make the clean energy transition that has been mandated by state law.
And, you know, after New York facing, you know, back-to-back climate emergencies, disasters, do you think that there's really meaningful climate action going on at the state level?
There is certainly meaningful action at the state level, but we're having kind of more success in some areas than others. I mean, we have made some really important strides to clean up the electric sector. And that's fundamentally important because the entire clean energy transition is really driven by a clean electric sector and then electrifying, you know, fossil fuel end uses throughout the economy, transportation, buildings. So we're doing a lot to kind of put the foundations in place and get us on a pathway to quickly cleaning up our electric sector. But in the meantime, we've been making just status quo investment in fossil gas infrastructure that is really jeopardizing our ability to have an equitable, affordable, and orderly transition. Continuing to make these levels of investments in the gas system are really going to create a rate crisis of, you know, just driving up rates as people start to get stop using gas. And the really unfortunate part about it is that, you know, disadvantaged communities, low-income folks, and others who don't have the same means to get off the system on their own are likely to bear the brunt of that disorderly transition.
In response to some criticism, the New York State Public Service Commission issued a press release stating that the approved rates were 37% lower than what the National Grid originally requested. There's still rates, though, that are going into effect that are higher, and as you said, the burden on some folks. And also, you know, trying to achieve that 40% reduction in pollutants like methane by 2030, that's not that far away. So what is National Resources Defense Council advocating that folks try to do to help, push back against these rate hikes and also just to increase the level of the ability to reduce these pollutants?
Well, NRDC is committed to ensuring that the transition to clean energy is equitable, affordable, and orderly. And this means prioritizing investments that reduce emissions and protect vulnerable communities rather than locking in methane gas dependence that will only increase costs and inequities over time. One example here, this authorization by the Public Service Commission effectively approved the replacement of 351 miles of functioning gas pipe. That's about the distance from New York City to Buffalo. Imagine if some of that money could have been redirected towards heat pumps, efficient electric water heaters, and other hyper-efficient electric appliances that could be installed in New Yorkers' homes, and could have done so in a way that avoids having to dig up the street to replace this outdated methane infrastructure that's really supposed to be there and last, for another 75 years, but it won't actually be used that long. And so that's why New Yorkers are likely to be stuck with the cost for a outdated system, outdated infrastructure that will soon be not used.
And with your work as the utility regulatory director in New York on climate and energy, what are you focusing on next? What's your priority now?
Two big priorities. The first is a legislative proposal called it's called the New York Heat Act, and what it does is works to alleviate some of the really fundamental conflicts between the public service law, which kind of directs the commission in how it regulates electric gas utilities, and our landmark climate act in New York. And what that bill would do is really enable us to redirect some of the money that is being poured into the gas system and again, redirect it to solutions that actually advance our climate and clean energy goals. So that is a really fundamental piece of legislation we've been working to pass for a few years. We got really, really close last year, and this next legislative session absolutely has to be the one where we get it across the finish line, because it is essential to enabling progress and to enabling a transition that is, again, equitable, affordable, and orderly. The other big piece of policy that's critically important is the need for New York to establish an ambitious cap and invest program. And what this would do is create a cap on the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that can be emitted every year. It would slowly reduce that over time. It would put a price on some of that emissions, and in doing so would raise a lot of money that could be then invested in clean energy solutions, bringing down the cost of those solutions for New Yorkers. So that's another critical piece of policy that needs to be established in short order. I mean, we're hoping to see a proposal before the end of the year.
All right, that's Chris Casey, New York Utility Regulatory Director for the Climate and Energy Program at the NRDC. More information at nrdc.org. Chris Casey, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, culture reporter Valerie Manzi is back with not one, but two artists at their artist talk at the Derby tonight. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and look who's back. It's culture reporter Valerie Manzi. We've got another artist talk at the Derby Hotel. You've been talking to a lot of the artists who've been doing these talks. And who do we have this morning?
Well, we have Rodney White and Kara Antelles.
And they're on the phone.
I hope I pronounced her name correctly.
Kara, did we get it right? Did we get it right?
You did.
Wonderful. wonderful.
And Rodney, good morning to you, too.
And so that event is tonight at the Derby, right over the bridge from Narrowsburg. And I believe it starts at 6 p.m. Am I correct?
Sounds right.
Yes, and there'll be cocktails and food, and the event of the evening is the always interesting and fun artist talk.
Kara, your paintings are layered and intricate, and you say you draw your inspiration from nature. Can you talk a little bit about folks on the radio and bring those to life a little bit. I've seen them, and Valerie's seen them, large, expressive. Explain to folks, if you can.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm very inspired by the local landscape, and I just get kind of fascinated by botanical forms. And then I'll like pick them and photograph them and make silk screens from them and work those into the painting. So I feel like, you know, we're so lucky to live in this landscape, and a lot of the inspiration for the work comes from that, you know, just things you see in passing, really.
They're landscape paintings, but you also believe in the power of art in public spaces, and you've had several opportunities in the public realm. Can you talk about some of your art and where it is in public spaces?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I really do believe in that. I love the concept of, you know, art meeting people where they are, and I think it just enhances your daily commute, if you commute, and so I was lucky enough to be awarded one of the commissions that the MTA in Manhattan, or the New York area, does. They have this program that's called Arts and Design, and they commission artists to make art that gets transmuted into the stations my project's in laminated glass, but some of them are also in mosaic. So they're actually, you work with a fabricator, and the art is made into, my art is actually the station. It's the glass that contains the station. So people see it every day in their daily commute. And I hope it helps them have a better commute. But it's really lovely.
Valerie here. Kara, can you tell us a little bit about the work that is on display with a number of other artists? The exhibit is called A River Valley Landscape. And tell us a little about the materials you use.
So, yeah, it's a great show that Judy and Randall curated at the Derby. And Rodney and I, you know, we both kind of explore landscape in different ways. And the materials I paint on either layered acrylic sheet or aluminum. And so both of these substrates have kind of a different way of talking back to you as opposed to canvas. So they're either reflective or they absorb color and shoot it back to you in different ways. And the reason I do that is because it kind of mimics how we see light in nature, and the light is always changing. And I really like working on those substrates because they're rigid. And so when you're silk screening and then oil painting and scraping, it's nice to have a rigid surface. Canvas can't always handle that.
Rodney, your work is bold. I think it's been described as postmodern, but you sneak in moments of nature too. Can you describe to folks more about your work?
I think of painting as a container. There's the front, the back, and the middle, which can hold anything you want to put there. So I layer imagery. Kara and I have that in common, although I layer it totally on a flat surface. And it can be images from all kinds of different sources, which include landscape paintings, historic sources. It could include actual landscape. Some of the paintings have images from movies in them, images from newspapers, and it all gets put in there, but under what is basically an abstract composition of color, because color interests me separately from imagery, and I use it to guide the viewer in and out and around the painting.
And I asked how you sneak in nature into your work, but I'm looking at a photo on the accompanying press release for tonight's artist talk at the Derby in what appears to be your studio, which is
facing a wall of windows and a forest of trees. So I can imagine how nature comes right in automatically.
Yes, it does. Even in my newer work, which is has a lot more abstract vocabulary, I'll finish a painting and I'll realize the colors I've used are right outside my window. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's there. It's always there.
Rodney, one of the things I noticed in looking at both of your works is that they are almost opposites in the terms of the depth of the color. One is more subtle and yours are so bright. And yet within yours, you still have all of that detail.
Yes, you got that right. I'm drawn to very saturated color. I feel color has its own light. So I use that with the light I can create when I draw the imagery.
And they're fun to look at because in there are these little images that one wouldn't expect to find.
Yeah, I want to maintain the viewer's interest so that it reads one way from a distance. When you get close, you see something else, and you can come back to it the next day and see something you didn't see the first time you looked at it. It's kind of what I want from a painting myself. When I look at art, I want to be engaged, and I want to have it speak to me every single time I walk by it.
Interesting. You know, when I was looking at your work, I don't know if a kaleidoscope would be the right thing to compare it to, but, you know, you just drawn in and in and in and in. I found it, and I've only seen it tonight. I'll get to see it in person, but I've just seen it online, and I was fascinated by my own experience.
Right. Well, that's perfect. I want the viewer is always bringing their own history and experience with them when they look at art, and that's how I want to engage them by triggering those experiences, if that makes sense.
Of course it makes sense.
And yeah, we're talking about artist studios, and Kara, there's a photo of your studio is too. And I have to say to both of you, I've never seen more well-organized artist studios in my life. You guys, is that part of your process too? I think, Kara, is in this photo, it's showing this wall of it looks like pre-existing forms of certain shapes. What is that? They're kind of clipped to the wall?
So what I do, you know, silkscreen, for those that don't know, silkscreen is a really simple printing process where you just take your image and wherever, it's kind of the opposite of a stencil. That's the easiest way to describe it. So that wall, for those on the radio, I have a big wall that I hang all my images. So I've collected all these botanicals and, you know, leaves and trees and flowers, and they're all made into silkscreens. And then when I'm creating the painting, I lay them down kind of to figure out where the placement goes before I actually put, you know, the actual one on the painting. So it creates this kind of like visual. It's fun to look at the wall of all the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it is. I mean, I can see that because the wall is like really tall and many different options to choose from. It's almost like you brought the trees that are outside Rodney's window into your studio. You've built your own tree.
Yeah. I mean, Rodney, nobody has a better view from their studio than Rodney. His studio is beautiful. I mine has trees in the back, and you know, they're an unending source of inspiration. And I really love being able to live and work in this landscape.
Well, we've been talking to Kara Antelis and Rodney White about their artist talk at the Darby. The Darby and Somewhere.co are presenting artist talks on the River Valley landscape. They've been doing it all summer. Tonight's talk is at 6 with Kara and Rodney. That's at the Darby, just across the river from Narrowsburg there in Beach Lake. Thank you both for joining us, and have a good time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Before we go, I want to remind you about One Small Step, the program here that we partnered with StoryCorps to put people together to have a conversation. One Small Step brings strangers with different political views together to record a 50-minute conversation, not to debate politics, but to learn who we are as people. It was created by StoryCorps, and it's an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us, even those with whom we disagree. So how it works is you go to our website, wjffradio.org, and you can learn more about it. You fill out a questionnaire, and then we match you with somebody, and you have a conversation. So just want to play an example of a conversation that previous participants have had in One Small Step. This is Al and Mani.
My name is Al Pola.
My name is Mani Mahadevan. We are talking from Charlottesville, Virginia, and this is the first time I met Al.
So why don't we start off? I'm interested to find out why your family left India to go to the United States.
Ah, so you want to know about my life. So,
absolutely.
So I was born in India, and my dad was a scientist, and he actually came to the U.S. back in 1964. How about yourself?
I was born in Havana, Cuba. My parents emigrated here in 1960. They always held out hope that they were going to return to Cuba. And the longer we stayed, the more American I thought of myself. Did you experience bias because you're a person of color?
Oh, often, especially since 2001. With a name like Mahadevan, it's close enough to Muslim name, I guess. So every time I fly, my suitcase has this little piece of paper in it, says it's a random check.
Really?
Yeah. So it's not random.
Interestingly enough, I don't think law enforcement identifies me as a person of color because I don't speak with an accent.
Do your kids get asked, where are you from?
No.
My kids do.
No. If somebody asked you, what's one thing you can do to make Charlottesville a better place to live, what would your response be?
Understanding that people who look different from you, people who have different religious beliefs, have the same struggles in life, you know, hoping for the best for your children.
Right.
Being allowed the freedom to pursue what makes one happy without hurting somebody else. There's a lot of fear of the unknown. I think that's what leads to misunderstandings and prejudice.
I agree. This is exactly what we need to do, is you need to have people come together and just get somebody else's perspective. Because if you won't listen to why I'm here, then how are things going to get better?
And we believe that, too. That's why we're participating in One Small Step, to help bring our communities together one conversation at a time. And you can be a part of that program. Go to WJFFradio.org, apply to be matched, and also learn more about participating. Again, WJFFradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that continuing coverage of the Democratic National Convention is tonight live from NPR News starting at 9. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
On Catskill Character this week, my guest is Bethel, New York resident Leah Maidenbaum. Please join us and hear Leah's journey from a child growing up in Israel, Switzerland, and the Bronx to eventually becoming an accomplished flamenco dancer, touring and dancing with Jose Greco. It's all on Catskill Character, Saturday at 10:30 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
And On Point is coming up next. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sun and clouds, a really nice day to be outside, a little warmer, high near 70, clear tonight, low 49, good weather for sleeping, I guess. Tomorrow, sunny, pleasant, high 74, and the sunshine and pleasantness continues through the weekend, according to the National Weather Service. Saturday's high 78, with periods of sun. Sunday, partly sunny, high near 80, rain back in the forecast, possible thunderstorm on Monday. You can stream us live at WJFFradio.org, or you can ask your smart speaker or smart device to play Radio Catskill. We're local news, culture, and NPR for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. WJFF Jeffersonville, it's 11 o'clock.